A QuickTime movie, but this machine doesn't play QuickTime. So hopefully, Callum, no, yes?
Sucks.
Okay, guys, stop Googling, stop surfing, just let Callum get on to the web. So what I want to talk about today is to carry on this theme of black holes. So I know you've already met black holes in the relativity course. You did the Schwarzschild and talked a bit about Kerr. And I want to basically go over similar ground again, but possibly in more depth, I'm never entirely sure, but talking about black holes and also trying to think ahead, because what I want to do is to move on and think about higher dimensional black holes and also discuss black hole thermodynamics a little bit. So today, we're just going to look at the two basic solutions in four-dimensional GR, which are the Schwarzschild and the Kerr solution, and we'll look at geodesics around those black holes. And the reason for that is we want to think about how we observe a black hole. How do we know whether or not there is a black hole in nature? What's going on? So, in terms of observation, the problem with a black hole is that it's black. Okay? We can't actually see it. So we have to deduce it's there, and we have to kind of look for a hole, something, you know, an absence of something rather than a definite presence. So one way of seeing that is via gravitational lensing. If we're really, really lucky, a black hole will go between us and a bright light source, and maybe we'll actually see some gravitational lensing of the light from the other source. But the main ways in which we deduce there are black holes in astronomy are by looking at orbits of other objects, so orbits of other things we can see, and also accretion disks. So, are we getting there, Callum? Oh, right. So how do we get the projector? There we go. We have a projector. No? I might have known just plugging it in would not be that easy. You know, it's just never that easy, is it? Especially not where I'm concerned. We've got it playing, but we can't get it playing on the projector. Yeah, we've got it. Good idea. Yeah. Good idea. Right.
It may need to be moved over.
Press it again. Press it again.
And it should resize it? No, it's ginormous.
Oh, there we go. Yeah, well, look, I'll tell you what, we got it now, so let's not push things. Let's just press play, okay? We may need to can you re-loop it or something?
Can you see the mouse?
Just press play. Oh, you can't see.
I can't see.
Bugger. Down. Down a bit. To the right a bit. Wait, too far to the left. A bit more. That's it. Play. Click. Now we're laughing too much to figure out what's going on here. Just keep you shouldn't have moved it. Just if you no, because will it play again? Well, that was why I was saying don't press full screen, because we need it to play again, Callum.
Will it play
No, not fire. Just.
There we go.
Okay. So this is how we deduce there's a black hole by orbits. So this is a sequence. Up in there, you can see the years ticking by. And this is a sequence of observations at the center of our own galaxy. So here, they're actually helpfully tracking the orbits of stars that they've been watching over a period of time. And you saw that star coming right in and whipping round something that you can't see in the middle. So here we go again. Shame the music's off, but never mind. And so from, I mean, that is incredibly fast in terms of sort of the normal stellar velocities. And that's telling us that somewhere in the middle, where there's absolutely no light, but it's essentially the center of our galaxy, there's something extremely massive and extremely small. So it's over a million solar masses, and that 10 light days, which you saw was, you know, in the zoom in close up, 10 light days was way bigger than the size of this object. And so we deduce, therefore, that at the center of our galaxy is a black hole, which is about which is millions of solar masses. So that's a supermassive black hole. So there you go. It's really, thanks, Callum. So whereas with stellar-sized objects, you could imagine, because of the tidal forces are still quite, now it's not going to go properly up, isn't it? The tidal forces are still quite relatively large for a stellar-sized black hole. How do you put this damn thing up? It's going to be one of those mornings. Okay. I think, this is... Yes, let go. Brilliant. Thank you. With stellar-sized black holes, there's still quite strong tidal forces, and I think for a while people held off being totally convinced that there were stellar-sized black holes, because neutron stars were not much bigger than this 2GM, the Schwarzschild radius. But when you have something like that, which is millions of solar masses, the tidal forces round about this Schwarzschild radius are still relatively mild. And it's very, very hard to imagine what would stop matter falling inside that Schwarzschild radius and becoming a black hole. So that's how supermassive black holes were discovered, by simply carefully watching orbits of other visible objects. But the way that we tend to observe stellar black holes is by looking at accretion disks. So the idea of the accretion disk is simply that you get usually black holes form in binary systems. So generically, there's usually a lot of binary systems in the galaxies. I mean, we're sort of in a failed binary system ourselves. Jupiter's not that far off being a star. And typically, if one forms a black hole, it will tend to suck in a lot of the debris, or sometimes even some of the mass of the other star. And so as this stuff falls in, it tends, because most black holes are rotating, it tends to form itself into a sort of pancake, a disk, in the equatorial plane of the black hole. And then it's sort of approximately sort of sits around for a while, co-rotating with the black hole, and gradually, you know, it heats up, it gets very hot by our standards, so we know it's there, it's sort of chucking out radiation, but eventually it gets sufficiently close to the black hole that it's kind of ripped in and pulled in and sucked into the black hole. But what astronomers can actually observe is a sort of typical profile of temperature, which they look for. I think it's particular some particular emissions from iron. And it peaks, essentially it's related, the peak to the sort of size of this in the edge of the accretion disk, and that in turn is related to the parameters, the mass, angular momentum of the black hole. So with that in mind, I wanted to look into the mathematics of finding these orbits to look at what you need to do if you want to analyze accretion disks. So what we'll do is we'll start with the Schwarzschild solution, because that's, of course, easier. So that's our Schwarzschild metric. We know it's idealized, completely spherically symmetric and static, but it's a good start. We can sort of get some feel for what's going on in this context. So you will have discussed, I guess, with Neil, that this 2GN, which I've called the Schwarzschild radius, is a special point as far as this metric is concerned. And it's what we call the event horizon, because inside inside 2GM, essentially T and R reverse roles from the point of view of the coordinates that we're using outside of 2GM. But geodesic from inside of 2GM can never get to large R, to large this coordinate R. So it's a coordinate singularity. And it's a boundary between events we can see and those we can't. And so we call it an event horizon. So there are several ways that you can explore why this is true. For today, we'll just talk a bit about geodesics. So for geodesics, remember the geodesic equation is a second order nonlinear differential equation telling you about the free motion of particles. So it's sort of the equivalent of F equals ma in a sense. It's telling you how particles move. So if there was no force, there'd be no acceleration. That's the zero. However, in practice, we don't necessarily want to deal with all four components of the second order differential equation, and there are certain shortcuts that we can take in finding motion and getting information about geodesics around a black hole. So, for example, if I rewrite out what these Levi-Civita symbols are, then I can do a first integral. So what this is telling me is that if I have any sort of symmetries, so remember when we derived the Schwarzschild solution, we talked about these Killing vectors, We said d by dt was a killing vector, the metric did not depend on t. And similarly, in the Schwarzschild metric, the metric doesn't depend on phi either. So there are no metric components that have a t or a phi in them. So this is telling you that you expect, since this right-hand side will be zero in those cases, you've got a first integral of this equation. In other words, a sort of conserved quantity. And so that tells you it's probably a better idea, instead of just going straight for the brute force second order geodesic equation, it's better to look at using these conserved quantities and thinking a little bit about the first order system. So, first of all, we're going to think about the symmetry. We've got spherical symmetry here. So we can always rotate a geodesic so that it sits in a particular plane, in particular the equatorial plane. And because we've got a central spherically symmetric metric, we don't expect there to be any angular kicks to our motion. So there's no reason to suppose, if we've got an object moving in a particular plane initially, there's no reason for it to suddenly be accelerated out of that plane. So we're going to use the spherical symmetry to restrict ourselves to the equatorial plane. So our geodesic is going to be some t of tau and r of tau, equatorial plane, and a phi of tau. So tau is the affine parameter, which is proper time if it's a normal observer, massive particle. So we know that the metric doesn't depend on t or phi. So we can use this result over on the right-hand board to tell us about some conserved quantities. So we've got gttt dot is some constant, and because it's to do with a t dot, we'll just conventionally call it E. And so, also, we've got something, a conserved quantity related to angular motion, which we'll just call angular momentum. But then, we also know from the geodesic equation that the length of our tangent vector, the tangent vector to our observer or whatever this geodesic is, has to be a constant. So if it was a time-like observer, that k would be 1, my signature, and a light ray would have 0. So the only non-trivial function left is r. So this relation here, given that we can replace T dot and phi dot by these conserved quantities, gives us a first order nonlinear equation for R. So that's just inputting the T, the R, and the phi into this summation over the functions that we've got. So here we can rewrite this. This form. So what this looks like is an energy equation. It's, I've forgotten the factor of a half, but it's basically looking like a kinetic plus a potential term. So we can think of this as particle motion in a radial potential. So this is V effective of R. So if we just look at our V effective and just think about the different terms, we've got for a massive particle, we start off with minus 2gm on R. So that's looking like some initial attractive potential well. Then we've got plus h squared on R squared. So that begins to look like a barrier. And then we have, eventually, an attractive 1 over R cubed. So this is just a sketch of what it might look like. So this is normal Newtonian attraction. This is like a centrifugal barrier. That would have been what you might have got if you were thinking about this from a Newtonian perspective. And this is the GR piece, the bit that's telling you that eventually gravity always wins, so that if you ever get close enough, you're always going to fall in to R equals zero. So you can analyze the orbits of a black hole by thinking about this particle motion in this well. So if you want the details of the orbit, then you can either do some sort of, you can do it analytically around some exact solutions, or you can just think about it qualitatively and think, well, if it's motion in a potential that looks something like this, then all I need to do is to know where E is, and that tells me where I am on the sort of vertical scale of this potential well. So if my energy was here, for example, then that would tell me, if you think about a particle rolling, you don't need to know the details to know that it's going to kind of roll between these two values of R. And what that's telling you is you're in some sort of orbit, elliptical type of orbit, where you've got a minimum R and a maximum R. doesn't tell you it closes, and in fact, of course, you know it doesn't, but that's the picture. You go between a minimum and a maximum R. If you're right at the bottom here, then that tells you that you stay there, nothing happens. So, actually I need colours for this, don't I? So this one here is a circle, completely circular orbit. If you're up here, on the other hand, okay, this means that you're unbounded. You're either going to shoot, if you're going in the positive R direction, you're just going to keep going. And similarly, that means that your trajectory is to come in from infinity, bounce off there, and go back out again. So this one is a scattering orbit around the black hole. Finally, if you get above here, all that will happen is you go in. And so that one here is where you end up getting sucked in by the black hole. So you can see, just by looking at this plot qualitatively, what sort of orbits are possible. And as you change the angular momentum H, you change the nature, you change the sort of details of the plot. So these, the maximum and the minimum here, could move together or move apart. So the location of this minimum here is sort of telling you something about where this term starts to beat that term. So that's just telling you about the size of the angular momentum relative to the mass of the black hole. And this turning point here, again, I'm speaking qualitatively in terms of trying to understand, you know, how you change things. That's telling you when this term beats that term. So this is now telling you a bit more about the angular momentum relative to GM. And so you can see that gradually you can tune these two turning points so that they eventually come together. And, oh no, I'm going to botch this at some point. So you get a point of inflection here. And that is a sort of, although that's a circular orbit, it's sort of neutrally stable, and it's the last time, if you like, the last point at which you can have one of these circular orbits. So let's just have a little bit of a look at circular orbits to see what we can actually get. So circular orbit . So that's telling you V prime to zero. And if you want your orbit to be stable, you want the potential to have a positive second derivative so that you're sitting in this well. So all you do is simply look at what that means for your effective potential here. So the first thing you see is if K is zero, so that's a light ray, if you've got a light ray, there's no sort of Newtonian potential here. And so as far as Newton was concerned, all the light saw was this sort of centrifugal barrier, which just meant essentially that it just sort of carried on going. But for general relativity, there is in fact an attractive component for the light ray. And so light rays are responsive to central masses, but if you want to try and form an orbit of a light ray, then if these two terms are now not there, so if V primed is zero, then you can see that V double primed is negative, because this last term here is 2h squared and r cubed, and of course you've got to multiply by 4, and if you do that you end up with minus 2h squared on r to the fourth there. But just because you can't have a stable null orbit doesn't mean you can't have a null orbit, because V primed equals zero, if we look at what that tells you, there's no K there, there's a common factor of H squared, and so what it's telling you is that R is 3GM. So there is a circular orbit, it's just not stable. So obviously that is definitely non-Newtonian, something that we wouldn't have got in standard Newtonian gravity. But notice you're only just outside the Schwarzschild radius here, so you're in a highly relativistic regime, which is what you'd expect if you're getting something that is well outside a Newtonian regime. So I suppose I should have noted or just commented about when I said this was the general relativistic effect. When you write it down in this form, everything sort of looks more or less the same size. You don't kind of think about relative orders of magnitude. But bear in mind that usually when you see a GM on R in gravitational solutions, there's a C squared hiding there, because I set C squared equal to 1. And what you've really got is GM on C squared R. And so you've got something that's kind of damping in R everyday sort of units. This thing really is very small. So just to sort of always bear in mind that often when you're doing high energy physics, you've set H bar equal to 1, you've set C equal to 1, and sometimes you can forget the natural orders of magnitude of things in terms of everyday effects. Because C is a big number and H bar is very small. So for a massive particle, on the other hand, K is equal to 1, and it turns out that we can have stable orbits, not surprisingly, since we know we've got them in Newtonian physics. But it turns out that, of course, as I was saying, we can have one of these marginally stable. So this is one of these inflection points where the maximum and minimum come together. So I've gone and scrubbed out the equations. But it's the V primed equation. If you remember, the second two terms here have an H squared in front of them. So you can write what h squared is in terms of g, m and r, the value of the orbit, so this one is from the V-primed equation and the second one is from the V-double-primed equation. And so when you try and satisfy those two equations simultaneously, you're led to a specific value of R, which is 6gm. So this is this innermost stable orbit. And so this is roughly speaking what's happening with that accretion disk, that you've got the particles in orbit, they're slowly losing energy as they radiate and crash against each other, so they gradually move inwards a little bit, the orbits decay, but they can still keep in a sort of roughly circular orbit whilst they're outside 6GM, but eventually they get to this innermost stable orbit and that's it. You know, the laws of physics tell you you've come to the end of the road and they get sucked into the black hole. So that's what happens with a Schwarzschild black hole, but of course we know that Schwarzschild is an idealized solution. So since I know you've met the Kerr black hole, just write it down. Well, what it means is that it's about to become unstable. So if we changed, what I'm doing is I'm saying that you've got this circular orbit. So if you know that if it's got a very big radius, it's going to be stable because the solar system is stable. But you let the radius come down and down. And as the orbit gets smaller and smaller, the potential that I sketched, the sort of minimum that's got, you know, you've moved it in, so you've shifted the minimum in, and gradually the maximum is coming to meet it. So at this critical point, you've got a point of inflection. So it's not really stable, it's neutrally stable, but it's about to become unstable. Sorry?
For its orbit to become unstable.
How do I have to? Sorry, did you say bump?
Yes.
Well, if you bumped it out, then it would move back into the stable regime. If you threw it in, it would go into the unstable regime. But if you analyze linear perturbations around the orbit, you would find that these going in or moving out perturbations would be at second order. You wouldn't see that at linear order. At linear order, you'd sort of see, well, I mean, actually, you'd see what we know is zero mode, where you would have no, you know, normally things are stable because if you perturb them, they oscillate sort of roughly simple harmonic motion around the point of stability. But as you're moving towards this critical point, these oscillations are getting longer and longer, right? Until it's like at the point it's about to disappear, it becomes a zero mode and then it's an instability. So marginal in this case means it's about to disappear. Have I finished writing the metric? Yes. So in this case, what we've done is we've added an angular momentum, or what we can interpret as an angular momentum, to our vacuum solution. And really what you can see we've done is the r and theta parts of the metric have become a bit more complicated, but they're sort of similar looking. But the theta and phi now, that's where the rotation of the black hole is showing up. So there's a cross term between the time direction and the phi direction, which is dependent on this parameter A. And so it's this cross term that's telling you about the rotation. You've got a sort of spiraling, if you look around in your T phi direction. And it's still got a U1 symmetry. You've still got the phi, d by d phi, being a killing vector. And you've still got a time-like killing vector. It's just that it's no longer time reversal invariant. So if you wanted to go back over in time, you'd have to change the sign of A, which is sort of what you would intuitively expect from rotation. If you reverse time, you're rotating in the other direction. So there's two singularities of Kerr. Did Neil do this with you about the coordinate singularities, the event horizon, the ergosphere? Yep. So I'll just go over it fairly quickly. So the event horizon is still spherical, but what's interesting about Kerr is that there's another region where there's a singularity. So here, this is delta equals zero. So when delta equals zero, you can see there's no theta dependence there, and you've got a 1 over delta here, so that's telling you there's something sick about your coordinates. But there's also a singularity where GTT goes to zero. So in other words, that is angular dependent because rho depends on theta. And what this tells you is that inside this region, you cannot remain at rest relative to an observer at infinity. That's all that means. All it's telling you about is an irregularity of the t coordinate, but that's not something which stops you from being able to see in that region. So as you move in from at infinity, T is a nice, normal, Minkowski observer, straight time coordinate. But as you move in towards the black hole, the sort of natural time is no longer this asymptotic time, and somehow things are co-rotating with the black hole. So this is a sort of, I guess it gets called frame dragging effect. But at this point here, even a particle moving near the speed of light would still be co-rotating with the black hole. Sorry, that's not very well said, is it? And you can undo this rotation simply by making a different choice of time which subtracts some part of the phi angle away from it. So if you change your notion of time to allow for the rotation, then once again you can look like you're in a local rest frame, but of course you're spinning round with respect to infinity. So we just like to do the same thing for geodesics around Kerr as we did for the Schwarzschild. So we'll take theta being pi by 2. We're in the equatorial plane. So we're going to try and solve our geodesic equation. And as before, we've got conserved quantities because our metric doesn't have a t in it and it doesn't have a phi in it. But they're not as nice as they were before. So that's what it would be in general, yep.
Will the motion of the particle be always in the plane?
If I take theta equals pi by 2...
It will stay there.
Yeah.
I'm saying that will it always, the motion will always be in the plane?
Actually, you mean if it wasn't on the equatorial
yes.
plane? Actually, I don't think it is. Because when you start looking at what happens to the motion of geodesics, they sort of wander... all over. I mean, I'm just trying to remember. I think because, of course, integrating up the GD6 for Kerr is a little more complicated than it is for Schwarzschild once you're out of the equatorial plane, because you genuinely do have a partial differential. So you're dependent on two variables, although you can separate the variables. But I'm just trying. I mean, I think what I'm remembering is seeing some sort of plots of people who've integrated up null geodesics around Kerr. And my recollection is that they do snake around. So, but I can double check that. I'll see if I can find that, where I saw that. Because I suspect there's probably quite a nice web page about that somewhere. I think there is. So. So just for keeping things short, I'm going to write V is 1 minus 2 gm on R. It's the Schwarzschild V. So that's my energy, or the equivalent of energy. So at first sight, it looks like, you know, things are, oh dear, they're getting rather, you know, rather complicated, and it's not quite so obvious how to deal, you know, make things look like we had with Schwarzschild. But in fact, if we define a sort of reduced momentum, I'm now looking at sitting in the T phi subspace, then what I'm really saying is, because we can't say there's some distinct time like we can with Schwarzschild, we've got a natural time, which is the time, the frame in which the black hole is stationary, but we can group this E and H together and think of it as a momentum. So the or something analogous to a momentum. And so this, of course, is what we wanted to look at, our first order equation, because the P is composed of conserved quantities. Gij is just given in terms of R for the equatorial plane. And so we've got our first order equation. Okay, so if you put in the numbers, that's what you get. So obviously, even if I wasn't in the equatorial plane, I could still do this. It's just it would be a lot more complicated because I would have had theta dependence all the way through. So if I look at my effective potential to see how it's generalized, so what I find is if I write it down, the reason I've written it this way is so we can see what's happened to the Schwarzschild potential. So we start off the same. We've got our Newtonian potential as before. But in terms of the 1 over r squared piece, we've now got some corrections to the centrifugal barrier. That's not surprising. If we're dealing with something that's rotating, we might expect some effect that we associate with rotation to be altered. But this is our general relativistic term, the 1 over r cubed piece. And you see that h has been replaced by h minus ae. And so depending on the sign of h, this is either bigger or smaller than it would have been in the Schwarzschild case. And so what that's telling you is if you are co-rotating or counter-rotating to the black hole, you'll have a slightly different effective potential. And that, again, is intuitively reasonable. Can I come back to that? Can I just finish off what I wanted to say and then we'll talk afterwards? Sorry, it's just such a small amount. So all I wanted to do is to just illustrate this particular effective potential with a very simple case. Which is a light ray in an extremal Kerr black hole. So I'm going to take GM equals A. And then I can choose E. We can always rescale. We can always rescale the energy to 1 for a light ray. So if I do that, then my V effective becomes simpler. And here you can see the effect of the event horizon. So the event horizon is now at R equals A. Then we can see that we can actually zero out the effect of potential if we choose H equals 2A. And so you can see the existence of a null orbit at the event horizon. And if you keep H equals 2A, you kind of see that you end up with this sort of picture where if you go outside, you roll off to infinity. If you're inside, you get captured by the black hole. And that is kind of saying, showing you how being inside the ergosphere doesn't mean that you can't communicate with an asymptotic observer. So this is still within the ergosphere, but outside this event horizon. So that's just, I'll stop there since we're, well, I suppose I started late, but what I've tried to do here is I've looked at geodesics surrounding our vacuum black hole solutions, the Schwarzschild and the Kerr metric. The motivation has been saying that, you know, in nature we observe black holes by looking at how they affect the objects around them. So, for example, that supermassive black hole, they deduced the mass of the object inside by looking at the orbits. That was, you saw the tracks of the stars. Similarly, accretion disks. That's a lot more complicated than tracing the the motion of stars or some other object going around the black hole. There, you're actually seeing light rays that have come from very close into the black hole on the accretion disk. So you kind of have to integrate out this geodesic equation, but the proper R theta dependent one, not just the simplified one. And you have to integrate that out for all of these light rays that are coming from the, you know, some region very close to the black hole in order to deduce what the actual wavelength of the photon was when it left the black hole so that you can get some information about what was going on at the, near, in the disk itself. So I want to go on to think a little bit more generally about black hole solutions. So what we're going to do is we're going to think a little bit about the fact that we can write down these general vacuum solutions. It's always sort of presented as being here's the Schwarzschild, here's the Kerr, but why is it so easy? Why aren't there a lot more different types of black hole solutions? And that takes us on to thermodynamics. So I want to, I mean, this week's going to be mainly black hole week, but, you know, the aim is to look a little bit about no-hair, about black hole thermodynamics, and maybe about different sorts of black hole type of solutions. So stop there.